Lately, I've been thinking that Rhode Island is somewhat like a conch shell. Viewed from the outside, it can seem plain, and the colors blending with its environment, but if you look at the inside, it is colorful and full of surprise. Also, like a conch, our state has its spiky bits. They are apparent as soon as you look at it, which definitely adds to the presence of the whole, and within are whorls and spirals of shining connection that spin inward and onward, intimate and intertwined. Intimate and intertwined as our state is now, it was even more so in its past. Years are coming, we just sang. Years are coming, speed them onward, when the sword shall gather rust and the helmet, lance, and falchion sleep at last in silent dust. Those words were written by a renowned Rhode Islander, the Reverend Aidan Ballou from up the road in Cumberland. Reverend Ballou was born in 1803, and he was an abolitionist and a passionate advocate for justice and early socialism and temperance. He was a universalist who eventually also became a Unitarian minister, forerunner of that union that comprises our modern faith. Reverend Ballou's writing was widely and well regarded, inspiring even the great Russian author Leo Tolstoy, who caused some of it to be translated into Russian in Russia. Most of Reverend Ballou's work was religious and social, but near the end of his life, in 1888, he wrote an utterly different book, an elaborate history and genealogy of the Ballous in America. And though the book traces the Ballou family all over the country, even to the Dakotas, most of the Ballous are from Rhode Island, and it is here that we find what was then much more recent information. It is in that book that we find what was then much more recent information about Aidan's cousin, Sullivan Ballou, who wrote the beautiful letter we heard earlier to his wife, Sarah. Sullivan Ballou was from what is now Smithfield and Lincoln, Rhode Island. He was born there in 1829. With financial assistance from family and friends, he was sent for some schooling in Massachusetts, and then he came back here and attended Brown University. He must have walked these very streets, walked up Benevolent to campus, and walked along Benefit on his way about town. He must have walked by this very church, this very same building that we are in now. It was built 13 years before he was born. He might have walked up our steps. poked his head in sometime to explore it, as many people still do now. Maybe he even came to a service here one Sunday. Maybe he sat in the very pew you are sitting in now. After getting his law degree in New York, he came back and was admitted to the bar here in Rhode Island in March of 1953 and began his career as a lawyer in Smithfield, where he worked the rest of his days. And in 1855, he married Sarah Hart Shumway from Worcester, Mass., and they started a family together. According to Aidan Ballou's book, people in Rhode Island considered Sullivan eloquent, able, honest, and fearless. In addition to his law practice, he became clerk of the Rhode Island House of Representatives from 1854 to 56, and then a representative from Smithfield in 1857. He was unanimously chosen Speaker of the House twice, but he refused the call the second time. And he also joined the Republican Party, through which he got to know Rhode Island's young governor, William Sprague. And with that connection, as Rhode Island began to muster troops, Sullivan Ballou was given a commission as major of the 2nd Rhode Island Regiment. This was Rhode Island's primary fighting regiment, and they were quickly sent down south, where on July 21st, they fired the opening volley in the First Battle of Bull Run, which was the first major engagement of the Civil War. While working to rally his regiment to push back a Confederate brigade from South Carolina, Sullivan was struck by a cannonball, which killed his horse and shattered his right leg. His leg was amputated, and he was too badly injured to be moved. The Union forces were eventually defeated and forced to leave Sullivan Ballou behind in the care of Army surgeons. Newspapers mistakenly reported that he had been killed on the field of battle, but in fact he died a week later, on the 28th of July. Rhode Islanders, they said, had no dearer son to lose. For reasons that are unclear, his grave in the yard of Sudley Church near the battleground was almost immediately desecrated by Confederate soldiers. What is believed to be his remains were later recovered by his friend, Governor Sprague, who traveled south to fetch them and brought them back to be interred at Swan Point Cemetery. Sarah Ballou lived for another 56 years. And though she was only 24 when her husband died, she, as you have heard, never remarried. She raised her two sons alone on a government pension of $29 a month, along with earnings from piano lessons. In 1875, she became secretary of the Providence Public School System, a post that she kept until 1899, when she moved to New Jersey to be near her son, William. Sarah died in New Jersey in 1917 and was buried with her husband at Swan Point, beneath a grave marker that quotes a line from his famous letter, "Come to me, and thither lead my children." That famous letter that we heard Bill Dolan read so beautifully earlier is not the only letter that Sullivan wrote to Sarah. In fact, there are at least 9 letters collected that he wrote in the few weeks between his enlistment and his death. All of them are affectionate, but none of them attain the same heights as his letter written that evening of July 14th. And this letter was not sent to her. Rather, it was found in his belongings, and it was given to her later. The original copy of the letter can no longer be found, and according to one story, it was buried with her. We lift up Sullivan Ballou and his family and his sacrifice and their sacrifice and his belief in a larger good, a larger imperative that was worth even his life. The Ballou family had been in Rhode Island since the late 1600s. Many of his own ancestors had served in the Revolutionary War. And surely he knew from the stories handed down what he would face. He believed utterly in the necessity of a real government of United States and in what he termed a debt that is always owed by individuals to what we believe in and rely upon. But it's not just his thinking and his sacrifice that strikes us in his letter. It's that clear, aching love that he feels for Sarah and his family that hits us hardest. This is not a warrior. This is a human being, as indeed they all are. A husband, a father, a soul, comforted by the thought of any form he could take to be near those he loves, even after death. Sullivan's letter reminds us, as if we needed reminding, that all those who fight and live or die, all those who serve, all those who risk, in wars or in resisting wars of our nation's making, that none of them is a uniform. Though they appear so in the uniform ranks of armored and anonymous shapes we see in images, but they are always people trying to do what's right and willing to lose even their lives in their belief that this is something that the larger life of a nation requires of them. And surely there are many of us, including myself, who would not be alive now were it not for those who fought and those who died in the wars that decide both history and the future. Whenever I see movies about war, whether they are documentaries or dramatizations, I always think the same thing. I always think how hard it is to safeguard our children, how vigilant we must be all the time, constantly, to keep them from falling down the stairs or electrocuting themselves with a socket or burning themselves on a stove or falling into a pool or being hurt in a car accident or any of us who has ever been charged for even minutes with the welfare of a child know how constant we must be. And even so, accidents happen. And mistakes are made and errors in judgment or estimations. Almost all of us are here now because one time or another, we were just lucky. A fraction of an inch or a second made the difference, and we were lucky. So fragile is every human life. And then after all these years and decades of vigilance and care, our young people go out into battle where the entire point is to kill or be killed. The senselessness of it is mind-boggling and dreadful. We must always mourn not exactly even the waste. Worse than that, the spending. The spending of humanity in battles and wars that have too often been ignoble and indefensible. It is not sweet and it's not fitting to die for your country. It should be that it is sweetest and most fitting to live for your country. And still we know that there have been wars fought to save people and to end atrocity, and we must always be grateful for all those who made the wrenching choice to fight in order to uphold humanity and save others. And this includes, of course, gratitude to all the veterans who are among us this morning. It is said all the time now, and we can never say too much thank you for your service. There are three great plaques at the far end of this meeting house for all those who served and died in the Civil War and the Great War and World War II. They have candles lit by them this morning and roses and garlands that our organist Fred put up so beautifully. The names of all those who also shared this very space, these pews, all of whom served, many of whom died, are set out for all time in those plaques that you can see at the back of our congregation there on the left, on the back wall, and over on the right. They are set for all time there, as they are in so many congregations across the world. The beloved lost we must remember, especially on days like this, the anniversary of a great peace, a peace that followed a war so unimaginably brutal, with its trenches and chemical weapons and gassing and wastelands of shells and barbed wire, that they called it the Great War because, of course, they believed that there would never be such another war again. Nothing could equal its brutality. It would remain the most dreadful, the most horrifying. We learned that was not true. We learned that howsoever we long for peace, that as much as people have all yearned for all people to live free and safe, our most precious records from thousands and thousands of years ago record that eternal truth, that eternal yearning, and still peace remains the most elusive vision. Even now, our country is at war. We are at war in Syria. We are at war in Libya. We are unofficially at war in Iraq. We are at war in Somalia and in Western Pakistan and in Afghanistan. We don't even acknowledge them all now. Many of them we don't call wars at all. They are liberation or intervention or operations. Without a draft and with spy planes and drones, we have insulated ourselves heavily from the full reality of our nation's actions and our military's engagement, of our troops' struggles and the battles that go on with no end in sight. Recently now, without even any more national conversation about the necessity for an end in sight. And so war is still present. And men and women go fight, and letters home are still written full of love and foreboding. In 2003, Private First Class Jesse Givens, 34, was deployed to Iraq, and he wrote this letter on April 22nd of that year. And we just heard this letter already. My family, I never thought I would be writing a letter like this. I don't really know where to start. I've been getting bad feelings, though. And well, if you are reading this, I searched all my life for a dream, and I found it in you. I would like to think that I made a positive difference in your lives. I will never be able to make up for the bad. I am so sorry. The happiest moments in my life all deal with my little family. Dakota, you are more son than I could ever ask for, and I can only hope I was half the dad. You have such a big, beautiful heart. I will always be there in our park when you dream, so we can still play. And I hope you will understand one day why I didn't come home. Please be proud of me. Please don't stop loving life. I will always be there with you. I'll be in the sun and shadows and dreams and joys of your life. Bean, I never got to see you, but I know in my heart you are beautiful. I will always have with me the feel of the soft nudges on your mom's belly and the joy I felt when I found out you were on your way. I dream of you every night, and I will always. You were conceived of love, and I came to this terrible place for love. I've never been so blessed as the day I met Melissa Dawn Benfield. I am so sorry I did not want to have to write this letter. There is so much more I need to say and share, a lifetime's worth. I married you for a million lifetimes. Please find it in your heart to forgive me for leaving you alone. I will always be there with you, Melissa. Do me a favor. After you tuck Toad and Bean in, give them hugs and kisses from me. Go outside to look at the stars and count them. And don't forget to smile. Love always, your husband, Jess. Jesse Givens died a couple of weeks after he wrote that letter, on the 1st of May, in a tank in the Euphrates River. That ancient river, the site of so many battles and empires. On this day, we remember the cycles of blessing that humanity will not abandon, and we acknowledge the struggle that humanity cannot transcend. Their boundless and timeless love and war and fear and courage and death and belief and love. Again. So too persists the reality that many of our troops, as they have across time, returned to inadequate care and opportunities and supports. May the day come when those who risk everything are better thanked and supported by the rest of us, when, if, they return to us. May the day come when no country chooses war, when no country is driven to war, when no country makes war on its own people or on those of other nations. On our Civil War plaque, which is the one back there, it says, as you heard in our joys and sorrows today, thus the teaching of this church bore fruit in the service of the nation. May some grain of goodness and compassion and respect that we try here and teach here, may it help that day, too long distant. May it help that day come when no one needs to mourn the dead or protest the war or heal from war, because finally, finally, we have learned to make real, real peace. Amen.